So welcome, David, to this recording that is happening on Kaurna land here at Christie Walk, where I live. We've just recently had Armistice Day.
Yes.
But it's a much celebrated day, isn't it?
Yes, and needs to be celebrated, I think, in the future in a much more aware way.
Because, I'd like to hear more about that.
Yes. Is no longer routinely called Armistice Day. It's usually called Remembrance Day. And I think that began happening around after World War II, when it was felt, the need was felt to commemorate Second World War service people, as well as those who had served in that awful disaster, the Great War. But I think the tendency of that somewhat has been to reduce Armistice Day to a kind of second-class Anzac Day, where the fallen and those who have served are celebrated, and I have no problem with that. If it's good enough for a democracy to send people to war, it's good enough for a democracy to remember them. But we have many sacred places of commemoration here in the city of Adelaide, but there's one peace park and there's not really a War and Peace monument in the city, apart from the relocated Dardanelle Cenotaph. Now, the council has done quite a good thing. It's maybe not the perfect thing, but they have restored the function, not the site, but the function at the site of where the Dardanelles Cenotaph originally stood here in the Southwest Parklands. And they've restored it as a site of reflection for the people of the Parkside suburbs, as was originally intended. That site of commemoration originally had a sacred wattle garden. The sacred wattle garden was made up of four quarters of 25 wattles each to commemorate the landing on the 25th of April, 1915. And so many varieties of wattle were planted that that grove would be forever flowering. There would always be at least one species of wattle around the year that was in flower, and that was to signify everlasting memory.
That's quite beautiful.
Very beautiful. And I think if that site were restored, if that wattle grove were restored, it would be a significant heritage tourism site.
Where is it?
It's just down halfway down Sir Lewis Cohen Drive.
Okay.
On the western side. And the council has put in some stone benches so that people can sit there, and there's a commemorative plaque about the significance of the site, which the council allowed me to write. And the site thus, as I say, represents restored function. There hasn't been an archaeological dig down there because we know that there would be clay paths that were the perimeters of the garden a few inches below the soil. And the garden, there's no allocation of funds yet to restore the wattle grove. But I'm very seriously considering making a deputation to the new council to propose that.
Good.
Yeah. But the point of it all is that I would like to see Armistice Day in the South Parklands celebrated in terms of the need to celebrate peace now, when there's a lot of warmongering going on. And we're being wound up to think, and it would be a folly as great as the Great War, that we could take on Russia, China, Iran, and maybe even India all at once. If not, possibly one by one, but even all at once. And this is just sheer insanity. And I think we need to develop ways of celebrating peace which speak to the heart of the Australian people. It's said, for example, that there's no peacenik like an old soldier. And I think if we could hook into the Anzac tradition and remember it as it truly was. I mean, Anzac was an absolute disaster. Yeah. There was a former governor general, a military man who led INTERFET in East Timor. And his opinion was that if the troops hadn't been so raw, they would have stayed on the beaches, because experienced soldiers would have realised that the job was way too hard, the terrain was way too difficult. They had to take three ridges on the crest of that peninsula. They only took two. So they were on the back foot from the day they landed. Things happened like at the neck, where there was a bottleneck and Turks and Australians faced each other across a very short stretch of land. Two of the Australian commanders weren't talking to each other. They were so miffed with each other about something, rank or interpretation of the task or what have you. And they had to coordinate their attack with naval artillery. Well, they didn't. They were 10 minutes out. So when the Turks were hammered by artillery, they had 10 minutes to get back in their trenches, aim their machine guns and start firing at the first wave of Australians. And the second wave of Australians went over and there were two more waves, and the question was asked, is there any point? Well, there never had been any military point, because their job was merely to keep the Turks in their place so they couldn't go somewhere else and attack Allied troops. There was no need for any assault whatsoever. There were no orders that couldn't have been interpreted in a wiser way. And so apparently a number of the men just turned to each other and said, it's been good to know you, mate. It's been good to know you, Cobber. And over they went and did their duty and died. A really, really tragic event.
It's somewhat dubious, isn't it, that we celebrate that?
Well, we celebrate the bravery, but celebrating the bravery was probably always a bit of an evasion, a way of ignoring the command failures. Mm. Certainly war's not to be celebrated, because tragedies of this kind happen in war all the time. And war, as General German said, is hell, as the Ukrainian people are finding out.
Language is very powerful, isn't it?
Mm.
So the difference between remembrance and armistice is powerful?
I think so, because it says that what's to be celebrated is peace. When peace broke out, hardly anybody was ready for it. Troops had been living in an existential time when they didn't know whether they were going to be alive or dead the next day. And their sense of time was telescoped. So when peace broke out, they didn't know what to do next. Whereas when the fighting was continuing, they had known what was right in front of them. If you ever want to experience that sense of time, Read Erich Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front, and he portrays that sort of halted time in the mind of a soldier very, very well.
How on earth would they recover from that, the ones that did survive?
Well, you recovered from trauma by adjusting to it, and your nervous system would adjust to it. So in a way, Australians, because we've participated in so many unnecessary wars, have a wide and deep experience of this, because there's always been the uncle who didn't talk about it, who went and came back and didn't talk about it. There's always been the odd one who would jump through the roof if a car backfired.
Mm.
Or as the song famously has it, when a chopper flies over. I know a person who suffered from trauma. She, it was not of a military nature, but she was a regular little trooper and got on with life. But at a couple of points in her life, and one in particular, she resorted to a fugue, which is to say she physically, emotionally and intellectually ran away from tension, from anxiety, from a renewed sense of trauma. I knew a bloke who was with the SAS in Foktui province in 1969 on his 21st birthday, and he responded by coming back and steadily drinking himself to death over 50 or 60 years. Very hard to get him to do anything else. Mm. So people who make decisions to send youth to war have a very serious responsibility, because probably nobody comes back to, goes to war and comes back from a war unmarked.
Mm. It seems a deliberate action by governments to encourage us to remember but celebrate.
Yes, they get us to remember in a certain way. Mm. And this is the problem. Anzac Day is simply not commemorated as an example of what happens to you when you rush into an imperial war and get a bloody nose. Mm. That's the true story of Anzac. Mm. But we are encouraged to think that it identified in us qualities which we are to celebrate. Now, bravery is to be celebrated to an extent. Foolhardiness is not. And you need to make the distinction. And we were engaged in that war in the most foolhardy ways. The Australian government of the day actually committed itself to war before the British cabinet did.
Why?
They were keen. They were keen, and they were part of a British imperial warrior race. And the empire, which was the dimension of community which they had front and centre, not the nation, was in their view threatened by Germany, by its rising imperial power. Now, we're being asked to consider at the moment that the rise of China, which is basically a return of China to a dignified place in the world order, is a threat to us. And our empire, that is the one, the system of allies and bases which the Americans lead. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and I think this could be celebrated every Armistice Day, Australia has no national interest in the Straits of Taiwan or the South China Sea that are worth the drowning of one single Australian sailor. We've got to identify our true national interest, not the national interest that's bandied about with an American flag.
And how would you define our true national interest?
Well, I think there's no contradiction between our national interests and the resumption of a full trade with China. China may be an authoritarian state. Very many of the allies of the United States are authoritarian states. Dictatorships can be ameliorated by not exciting their paranoia. And I think that is our interest. I'm not saying that it will necessarily gain immediate democratic goals, but it certainly has better prospects in the long run of being safer for us and better for the peoples ruled by these regimes than hitching our flag to the coattails of an antagonistic empire which has invaded more countries in the world than any other since 1945. There'll be a discussion of an alternative defence policy and an alternative foreign policy for Australia. I think this thinking about Armistice Day and the Australian popular military tradition, which needs to be interpreted in an unimperialistic way, leads us to thinking about participating in that kind of review.
Can I just pose something to you that been put to me by my friends in Guam, or Guam, as they call it. They have three military bases on an island, three American military bases on an island that takes you 40 minutes to drive around end to end. And there's they're trying to build a fourth, and they contaminate that beautiful tropical island. It's terrible what happens there. But it's a stone's throw from Taiwan.
Is it?
Yes, yes. It's a very short flight from Guam to Taiwan, and it has a lot to do, I think, with China wanting a regain control of Taiwan.
Yes.
Well, because it really literally is within firing range.
Yes. Well, these four B-52s that it's proposed to station at Tyndall in Darwin are aimed at China. Long-range bombers, nuclear-capable. It's said that the last few times that an American attack on China was war-gamed, that the two sides came out equal and fought each other to a standstill, but the difference was made by long-range bombers. So the Chinese are not going to take these bombers at Darwin lying down. You know, that's a provocation as far as they're concerned. And we're not getting the proper news about what's involved. Mm. For example, there's all this song and dance about China reinforcing islands in the South China Seas. The argument is that China has no real claim there. But in fact, China has always had a claim there historically whenever it wasn't weakened and colonised. For the Philippines and Vietnam have a claim there. Some of them are being negotiated, I understand. But as to China, you know, there are two Chinas. Well, there's a one China policy, which we seem to be receding from. But nationalist China, Taiwan, claims the South China Sea as well because it claims to be the Chinese government and it maintains Chinese national claims. So in terms of us standing up for democracy, it's a little bit difficult to do because there are all these competing claims and something has to be sorted out about all of them. Now, the Chinese have never accepted the nationalist claim to Taiwan. That happened in 1949, that the nationalists retreated to there and maintained their claim to the mainland. Well, the mainland never accepted that. And we don't know anymore the true complexities of the question.
It's very interesting, isn't it? The machinations that go behind what we're fed.
Yes, and what we're fed is very 1984. Wars go on the frontiers of the empire, but the citizen walking down the street in the metropolitan centre does so unimpeded by any crossfire and largely of limited awareness of what's going on because all we get is the empire's news feed. And the civilian population, the national population, is thus fundamentally gaslit. And this was a phenomenon that George Orwell identified as newspeak.
How did he know?
Well, he had seen the activities of the Stalinist state in Spain. And he was inside the socialist movement, and he saw authoritarianism as a part of the socialist movement, and he knew how it worked. So in a way, he was predicting with secure knowledge of the past.
A lot of foresight then.
Yeah, well, 2020 foresight, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now that's really interesting.
Mm. So we must stand up against this propaganda.
Mm.
We don't even realise that we're part of an empire, whereas Australia is essentially a client state of the United States. Mm. We've got formal sovereignty, but if we were to act too independently, we would suffer 1975 all over again,
mm.
and maybe not so nicely.
I think that's a very scary place to end it on.
Yes, it is, but lest anyone think that we're not an imperial client, remember that the Athenian Empire was democratically governed as well. And it was an empire of alliances and bases, which didn't directly rule in the way the old British Empire did, but it was still an empire. I am determined not to go to war for that empire because I don't think it's ever been worth an Australian life. I don't think the Great War was worth Australian lives. But the more we think in terms of blind loyalty, the more likely that we are to be dragged off to fight again with our cousins.
And do you see that as imminent?
I see that as all too possible. And it could be imminent. If it was going to happen at all, it might happen next year or the year after.
Gosh.
But let's hope that it won't, and we can keep stringing it out for long enough that people will begin to start thinking in the way they did about Vietnam. The Vietnam War in Australia was very popular in 1966. By 1972, people had thought better. That's what we must aim for. Another peace movement of that scale and range. To commemorate, for example, every Armistice Day.
And the whole conversation came about through a supposed celebration of peace breaking out.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I mean, peace is a quality I think that any soldier can tell you about, you know. It might seem ordinary having a roast on a Sunday afternoon, and maybe is that's maybe what's peace, so peaceful about it. Because the extraordinary is what happens on the battlefield, and that's hellish. It's people are traumatised because it's all too much to bear.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to add any more?
No, I think I've taken enough risk of scaring everybody.